From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! What did Princess Diana's security guard have that she didn't? The combination of seatbelt and airbag. We speak with Public Citizen's Joan Claybrook. Then testing our children. As schools open around the country, we look at how states evaluate kids. What happens to children in the juvenile justice system? And we premiere a song with Patti Smith, The Ballad of Abner Louima. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Less than a week before the start of talks on the future of Northern Ireland, three Sinn Féin leaders arrived in the United States yesterday to begin a whirlwind tour seeking clout and cash. Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams, upon arriving at Kennedy International Airport, said his party is committed to achieving a united Ireland through peaceful negotiations. He called the talks the last best chance this century to end the violence in the British province. The foreign minister of Congo has told Secretary General Kofi Annan in a telephone conversation that obstructions raised last week to the investigation of alleged killings in the eastern part of the country have been lifted. This according to the UN spokesperson. The spokesperson, Fred Eckert, said the Secretary General Annan had demanded a promise in writing that the work of the investigative mission would not be blocked. Eckert said Annan had given the government of President Laurent Kabila until noon today to send an assurance, but that the deadline had passed without one. This news from the West Bank. Jewish settlers threw stones at Palestinian laborers and lay down in the street today to disrupt work on an American-financed road project in the heart of the divided West Bank town of Hebron. David Muirhead, an American engineer overseeing the work on Shuhada Street in Hebron, said a settler fired an air gun at a mechanical digger, shattering its window. He said the Israeli police responded to settler concerns but ignored those of his Palestinian co-workers. This in the Washington Post today. The White House yesterday mounted a detailed defense of Vice President Gore and his appearance at a Buddhist temple fundraiser just 2 days before congressional hearings into campaign finance improprieties enter a new stage with the spotlight focused squarely on Gore. Officials release a series of internal memos, electronic messages, and briefing papers intended to prove that Gore was unaware at the time that the 1996 luncheon at the Shilai Temple in California was a fundraising event. But the documents offered ample evidence that at a minimum, Gore's staff ignored numerous warning signs that could have averted what has become one of the major embarrassments of Gore's career. And one email message from Gore himself 6 weeks before the event made clear that he expected to attend a Los Angeles fundraiser on that date, although aides said the temple was not the planned location at that point. Attorneys for James Earl Ray made another attempt yesterday to get his guilty plea thrown out and get him a trial in the 1968 slaying of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Citing a state law in place when Ray pleaded guilty, attorney Andrew Hall said Ray should have been granted a trial in 1969 because the judge died before considering Ray's request to withdraw his guilty plea. The law, since repealed, stipulated that a pending motion be granted if a judge died before making a ruling. The leader of the nation's largest black church received another vote of confidence, even as a prominent group of pastors promised to fight for his removal at the denomination's annual meeting. Hours after the Reverend Henry Lyons opened the annual meeting of the National Baptist Convention USA with a plea for forgiveness, delegates approved a resolution urging an end to an internal church investigation into his financial dealings. However, it was the timing of the vote, when more than half the delegates had already left, that was the final motivation for the coalition of dissenting pastors, who said it was an orchestrated effort by Lyons to bypass the membership and keep his job. As more than 150 supporters looked on from the steps of the Colorado Convention Center, the pastors, including all four candidates who opposed Lyons in the 1994 election, demanded that Lyons resign immediately or be expelled from office for allegedly mishandling church funds. The pastors called on Lyons to suspend regular business today to give the membership an opportunity to discuss whether he should stay in office. If Lyons keeps his job, the pastor said they will withhold funds from the convention and release documents showing Lyons is guilty of financial misdeeds. Prosecutors pressed yesterday for the chance to do their own psychiatric examination of Unabomber suspect Theodore Kaczynski, saying it's only fair if the defense argues that he's mentally impaired. Meanwhile, 8 Fort Bragg soldiers have been disciplined following an investigation on complaints of sexual harassment and other inappropriate conduct. Army officials have not released the names of the 8 soldiers, which include both men and women, and all 13 soldiers were investigated at the North Carolina base. And a Pentagon spokesperson says officials are considering testing a ground-based laser by zapping a dying satellite in space. The test would involve a military laser located at White Sands, New Mexico, and an Air Force satellite that has reached the end of its useful life. The spokesperson says the Army, which is in charge of the laser, has already tested it, quote, on a variety of things. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We don't know exactly what happened in the famous Mercedes-Benz crash in Paris that killed Princess Diana, her companion Dodi Fayed, and their driver Henri Paul. But we do know that Diana's security guard, Trevor Rees-Jones, who was sitting in the front passenger seat, survived. We also know that his airbag inflated and he was wearing a seatbelt. We're joined now by Joan Claybrook. She's the president of Public Citizen, which is a research and advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. She was formerly the head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration during the Carter administration. At this point, Joan Claybrook, though we don't know everything, what have you learned from this crash?
What we do know in the front seat, anyway, of this vehicle is that the airbags did inflate, and The security guard was protected by an airbag under an extraordinarily violent crash. And while he is still in quite serious condition, nevertheless, he has survived. And that's what the airbag is designed to do. It's designed to provide that extra padding so that your body is not thrown violently around the interior of the vehicle, which is what causes the injury. When the car stops moving, the bodies of the people in the car are still going at the speed at which the vehicle crashed. So if that vehicle crashed into the wall at, let's say, after braking was involved, let's say at 70 miles an hour, the bodies are still going 70 miles an hour even if the car has stopped. And so they're thrown violently inside the car against whatever is there. And if there's invasion of because there's the car has crushed, then they have less space for being protected. And that's why the airbag is so important. It's a cushioning under violent conditions.
And yet the airbag has been much maligned, and a lot of information has come out over the months. Most recently, the U.S. government deciding whether to say it's okay for people to actually detach the airbag so that it won't go off, the information that it's killing kids and small people. What is your response to that after many years of your advocacy for mandating that auto manufacturers put airbags in cars?
Well, there's no such thing as one design of an airbag. There are various designs of airbags. And I believe that the manufacturers did not design the airbags properly in many cars, and therefore they have caused harm. We did an analysis last at Public Citizen with the Center for Auto Safety in July of the way the airbag inflates. And one of the problems with the airbag where people have been harmed is that there's an interaction between the person to be protected, the occupant, and the airbag. While the airbag is inflating, it has to come out very rapidly in order to be there in time. And as you can tell from the crash in Paris involving Princess Diana, the airbag came out very quickly. And it has to do that in order to protect people in these crashes, which are instantaneous. But you shouldn't be right in the path of the airbag at that moment that it's inflating. And you design airbags so that people aren't there. Some airbags have been designed so they're vertically inflating, primarily vertically inflating. And that means that they crawl up the windshield, and then they come into the occupant compartment. And they're located right up there where the windshield and the dashboard meet in that little corner of the front of the car. There have been no people killed or seriously injured that we know of with a vertically inflating airbag design. There have been, every person who's been killed has been in a car with a horizontally inflating airbag. That is one that's located right in front of the person sitting in the passenger seat, and it comes directly at them. And so we believe that the airbag is a magnificent device, that it's designed to protect a wide variety of sizes of people, but that it has to be properly designed. And there are other factors involved. For example, in the driver's side, for small women who have been harmed, the airbag can be put in a deep dish steering wheel arrangement, such as the 1955 Ford, for people who are old enough to remember that, which was an attempt to get the steering wheel further away from your chest. And there are various other designs in terms of the way that the bag inflates that can protect people.
How does a person know whether they have a vertical airbag or a horizontal airbag?
They don't know. And we did put out a list of the ones that we knew, and the way that we figured it out was we went down to the Department of Transportation and we looked at all the crash tests that they'd done, and it's not every make and model, but most of them, and we watched them as they inflated, and we put them in slow motion. And then we put out the list, and we check with manufacturers, and so we believe it's pretty accurate. But the best way to do it is to ask the dealer. If the dealer doesn't know, ask them to call the manufacturer and find out.
And if you have one, can you replace it with the other?
No. I don't think so. First of all, it has to be top-mounted, that is, mounted right up against the windshield. If it's a horizontal, if it's a front-mounted airbag, it's very difficult to make it work the way it should as a vertical airbag. It's too close to you already.
We're talking to Joan Claybrook. She's president of Public Citizen and has long advocated airbags in cars. Do auto manufacturers know that vertical airbags are much safer than horizontal ones?
Absolutely.
And so
manufacturers know a huge amount. They knew in 1991 that small women were being harmed in the driver's side. Excuse me. And they covered it up. They, in the Department of Transportation, didn't tell anybody. And some of them made design changes. They've been making design changes ever since they first started putting these airbags in cars. And so a lot of the manufacturers are very responsible. They have been trying to improve their airbags. But that's in terms of design, and they're getting better, and they're going to get better. But the problem is that they haven't told people which is which. And they don't want to because it hinders the sale of their cars, and they also don't want the liability. So, and the Department of Transportation hasn't either, which I am very critical of. The Department of Transportation has done some crash tests, which they won't reveal to us by make and model, and we've sued them to get the information.
On what grounds do they keep it secret?
They said that they promised the manufacturers that they wouldn't reveal the information because the manufacturers gave them some advanced airbag designs. Well, we're interested not in the advanced airbag designs, but in the baseline vehicle, which are current models that they tested as a part of the whole test process.
When you were advocating for so many years for airbags before they were required to be put in cars, did you know about these distinctions?
Yes. We issued a standard in 1977, which was a broad performance standard because the manufacturers said they needed design flexibility to make the best design. And when General Motors came in 1979 and told us that they were concerned about out-of-position children being harmed by the airbag, we did a massive, over $1 million worth of testing with some contractors, and we came back and said, you should have at least three characteristics of your airbags. One is they should be top-mounted. Second, they should be dual inflation, which no cars have today, although it's very feasible, as the suppliers have made clear on the public record.
Dual inflation.
Inflation airbag is one that comes out more slowly in low-speed crashes, and that's where most of these people have been killed, inadvertently or unnecessarily, and higher speed in high-speed crashes. So you'd still have the advantage of protecting the driver in the passenger, front seat passenger, who was in the car with Princess Diana, and yet you would not harm smaller children or someone who was leaning up against the dashboard inadvertently when the airbag inflated. So, in a lower speed crash. So, those are two key characteristics that we recommended, and a third was the proper chambering of the airbag so that the way the air came in was as harmless as possible. Anyway, there was a number of recommendations. That was in 1980. And the manufacturers at that time were still fighting to get rid of the standard. When Ronald Reagan became president, they went to him. He did their bidding and revoked the standard. The Supreme Court overruled him, the president, and it was reissued in 1984, and airbags first started appearing in the late 1980s. And the manufacturers had, instead of spending all that time voluntarily offering airbags for sale, doing some initial work and testing, perfecting the designs, they were fighting it politically. And then all of a sudden, they had to meet the standard. And they had a lot of choices to make, and they made some lousy choices. They also had them inflated at a very low speed, which means that there are a huge amount of exposure of people in low-speed crashes. You know, most crashes are below 20 miles an hour. And you don't need an airbag, really, until at least 15-mile-an-hour crash.
Joan Claybrook.
But they inflate much, much below that.
I almost get the feeling right now when I see all the information coming out in airbags that, I mean, the manufacturers were dragged kicking and screaming into putting airbags into cars. And now it's a sort of, you know, we told you so. And I almost get the feeling that in the end they're going to be taken out. What's your sense of the trend right now?
I don't think so. I mean, I think people are beginning to see how fabulous the airbags are. A lot of lives have been saved. Over 2,000 lives have been saved. And you have dramatic examples such as the one in Paris, which shows what the airbag can do. And people want to be protected in car crashes. But I think that the real pressure here has to be on manufacturers perfecting their designs, so that they work well in all types of crashes and they service all types of passengers. And essentially what they did was to design them to meet the very narrow particulars of the safety standard, which were broadly written, but only required a test with an adult male. And the standard now is being rewritten, must be rewritten, to require tests of small women and children as well as adult males, because the manufacturers took advantage really of their position. Instead of designing them well, they just decide to meet them just the very particular requirements of the standard.
And what about rear seat airbags? I understand that in this Mercedes-Benz that Princess Diana was in, that there actually were rear seat airbags that came out of the sides and, you know, going in toward the middle of the car.
There are some side impact airbags. I was not aware that this car had them.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they came out or if I thought I once saw a model of it.
Right. But I don't think she had her belt on, which certainly would have helped. And I also don't know whether this was a limousine, but most limousines have a window between the passenger and driver.
No, it wasn't. Right.
It was not a limousine?
This was just a regular Mercedes-Benz.
It was just
heavily
armored. Just a regular one. So certainly the belt would have helped, because she was obviously slammed up against something. It's unclear what she was slammed up against, because she had some serious chest injuries. And so she would have been, I think, protected and maybe have lived if she had her belt on.
Well, that's a story that everyone knows, is the story of seat belts. But maybe one more time in the end of this discussion, you could talk about the importance of seat belts.
Well, seat belts are extremely important for holding you in place. Airbags work primarily in frontal crashes, and now they have them for side impact crashes. Safety belts hold you in place. It helps the airbag do an even better job. And also, if you have a rollover crash, they're essential. If the door flips open, you don't go out of the car. Seat belts are critical, but it's really both of them are safety restraint systems. They work in tandem. They work together. They should work together. They're a team in a way, and I guess Princess Diana didn't have either one to benefit her, apparently the security guard had both, and his life was saved, and it just goes to show that these systems are in these cars for a reason, and they work, and they're fabulous, and people should use them.
Back to the issue of airbag one more time. Do you think that people should be able to voluntarily disconnect them?
No. I think that that's a terrible proposition. I think the government made an enormous error in doing that. I think they did it under duress because of the publicity over the deaths that have occurred. And the manufacturers, the dealers, the insurers, the consumer groups are all opposed to disconnection. If the government says, well, you can disconnect, then people will think, well, the airbag doesn't really do any good, and it's not true. Many people will be killed if they disconnect their airbag. And right now, what's happens is that if you have a medical reason why you have to disconnect your airbag, and there are some people who do, you can write to the Department of Transportation and get permission to do that, take the letter to the dealer, and you will get your airbag disconnected.
But I understand there are now some makes where you can put in a key and just disconnect it for that particular ride.
No, they're on-off switches in some pickup trucks that don't have any rear seats, so that if you have a child restraint, which should not be in the front seat of a car with an airbag, then you can turn the airbag off. And that's another option that the Department of Transportation is considering. My view is that you should never disconnect the airbag, but instead there should be an on-off switch installed if you have a medical reason for having to turn it off, because there are going to be other users of the car who are going to want that airbag, the car is going to be sold, and so on.
Well, Joan Claybrook, I want to thank you very much for joining us, president of Public Citizen, which is a nonprofit public interest advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. If people want to get a hold of your information on airbags, where can they call?
They can call to 202-588-1000.
That's 202-588-1000. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, it's back to school this week for families around the country, and school testing groups are unveiling studies that claim students are scoring higher in standardized tests nationwide. Officials who administer the SAT, ACT, and National Assessment of Educational Progress tests say that even though the exams are being taken by a broader segment of the population, significant progress has been made in science and math scores over the last several years. Still, the issue of testing remains a contested topic among many educators, parents, and activists. And we're joined now by two of them. Monty Neal is with us. He's Associate Director of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, which is called Fair Test. It's a testing reform advocacy group based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we're joined by Susan Harmon, who is a special education teacher in Contra Costa County, California. She teaches at the Lake School in Richmond. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! I wanted to start with Monty Neal, who has come out with a new report, Fair Test has, called Testing Our Children, a Report Card on State Assessment Systems. What is your take on states' testing of kids?
Well, most of the state testing programs that we looked at, all 50 of them, most of them are quite poor. They fail to test or assess students on many things that students, we would hope students would learn. In particular, they do not assess students' ability to think in a subject area, to analyze, evaluate, create new knowledge, or to apply their knowledge to real-world situations. And most states simply don't assess that. That means that they don't assess to their own state standards. It means often that because schools feel pressured to teach to the test, that the kids are simply not taught those things, and they really ought to be taught about it. They need it for their later lives. It makes school more interesting, in fact. For a lot of reasons, it ought to be part of state assessment programs, but most state testing programs rely entirely or almost entirely on multiple choice items. That is, some people call them multiple guess. You get to pick the answer. It really tests recollection and recall and simple rote application of information, and not any higher order thinking. And many of the states use what's called a norm reference test. That is, they compare kids to each other rather than to measuring the extent to which they have learned the basic or advanced content that we expect them to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of states make what we call high-stakes decisions. That is, important decisions like whether to promote a student grade or to give them the high school diploma. They make those decisions based on a test score. That is a serious test misuse. The industry itself basically acknowledges that you should not do that. But often politicians go right ahead and decide to do it anyway. This has obviously harmful effects to kids who should have passed but don't pass because they're not good at that particular type of test taking, like multiple choice tests. And it has very harmful effects on curriculum and instruction because it puts even more pressure on teachers to just teach what's on those pretty narrow tests.
In terms of states, which states do you think are doing the best when it comes to evaluating students?
Well, in our very top category, we rated Vermont as the only one. And the reason we did that was that they do two things. They have a portfolio, that is, a collection of actual classroom work that students do in a subject area. And these portfolios are scored by their kids' own teachers, but a sample of them, that is, say, 5 out of a classroom of 25, are rescored by people from outside the school in order to be a check on how well, how accurate and fair the teacher is in her own scoring. This means that what you're finding out about kids' learning is based on the real work they do instead of on a one-time, fairly trivial test. The state does have tests in some subjects. These tests, however, have either no multiple choice or almost no multiple choice. What they do is ask kids to think and solve problems. I've looked at some of the problems on those tests, and they're actually they really require some thought. You cannot answer them just by memorized information. You have to think about it. Now, you have to have the knowledge, the factual knowledge, the procedural knowledge, and the information in order to be able to answer them, but that's not enough. So they're really sort of advanced kinds of tests. A few other states have something similar in their state testing program. Maine does quite a bit of that and has no multiple choice. New Hampshire is about half and half. Colorado is going to be is just starting a system that looks to be in the order of about half and half. Missouri, the same thing. Again, it's just starting. Kentucky has had its system for a while. It does do some portfolio stuff, relies primarily on tests that have some multiple choice, but mostly not. But they're not quite as far along the path as Vermont is.
What states are worse?
Well, at the bottom are states that use all multiple choice or almost all multiple choice, use the norm reference test, that is, compare kids to each other and make high-stakes decisions, and test in a lot of grades. So you have a state like Tennessee. Tennessee isn't norm referenced. It's criterion referenced, but they test in virtually every grade, and it's entirely multiple choice, and it's quite high stakes. You have a state like Texas, which does a lot of what it does actually quite well. It informs the public well about what it's doing. It does serious bias review on its items, that is, to try to make sure the items are fair. But it's entirely multiple choice and very high stakes. And so for those reasons, we think a state that goes in that direction is not so good. A state like California is an example of one of the few states that's moved really in a bad direction. Most states are actually slowly moving in slightly better directions. But what California did, it actually had the beginnings of a fairly decent system, both in its statewide test and because it put a lot of money into helping local schools and districts develop classroom-based assessments, things like portfolios. The governor succumbed to extreme right-wing political pressure and vetoed the reauthorization of that assessment program in California. And since then, California has just moved in terrible directions. It is possible. I haven't heard the latest news, I suspect, but what the governor is pushing for is that everybody in the state is going to have to take, or almost all the kids in the state will have to take, a norm referenced off-the-shelf multiple-choice test.
Well, Monty Neal, we actually have someone from California with us. Again, Monty Neal, Associate Director of the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, known as Fair Test. Susan Harmon joins us from the Oakland area. She's a special ed teacher in Richmond, California, at the Lake School, which is a public school there. Susan Harmon, tell us about testing in California, an issue that you have written about in education journals and deal with all the time as a teacher.
Monty's right. One of the reasons I came to California is because of its progressive testing policy or assessment evaluation policy. The state was moving away from multiple choice norm reference testing to actually asking children to do real tests, the kinds of tests that they do in classrooms and in life. 2 years ago, that began to change in some serious ways. 2 years ago, that began to change in some serious ways. The state passed what we call the Bounty Bill out here, which offered districts $5 a head for each child that they tested, which, of course, doesn't cover the cost, but was the real incentive for some districts to go back to using off-the-shelf multiple-choice norm reference tests. The state appropriated about $20 million, and at last count, $9 million was spent. About half the kids in the state were tested under that bounty, under the bounty bill. And then a year ago, we passed another law, which really is going to gut the state frameworks. Our language arts frameworks were some of the best. Frameworks were a set of standards, but quite open, not picky item by item. Sort of, the children will learn 27 skills in fourth grade. They were very open and gave teachers a lot of leeway and autonomy. And this new bill, which was passed a year ago, will essentially gut the frameworks, replace them with what we're calling standards, which are the dog that's being wagged by the tail of testing, because the standards are going to have to be testable, which means first we'll think about an easy way to test them, and then we'll put the standards in place. And I'm delighted to hear from FairTest study that not all states are going in this direction. I was afraid that California, which is such a huge educational market, would be leading the rest of the country.
Susan Harmon, how did you get involved with the whole issue of testing?
I was a school psychologist, and what most school psychologists spend most of their time doing is testing. The tests are slightly better because they're individual tests. They're not whole class tests, and it's one-on-one, and you spend a lot of time with the child, but they're still norm reference tests. They still compare one child to another, and they still have a standardized, rigid format about how you try to find out extremely important things about children. Monty talked about the multiple choice tests, the achievement tests that we're all familiar with being high stakes, but the special ed tests are even more high stakes because they can put a child in special ed, and that can be the end of that child's road in education. They can stay in special ed for the rest of their lives and get what I think is a much lower quality education.
Go ahead.
And it seemed to me that the tests were what was standing between quality education in this country and, well, between getting there. Mm-hmm. You know, that teachers who were doing wonderful things in classrooms, wonderful progressive teachers, the whole classroom, all the activities, all the projects that were going on would grind to a halt in the spring, and they would stop and ask children to stop cooperating with each other and collaborating and sit by themselves at a lonely spot and work on something that didn't require any thinking at all.
Moni Neal, I wanted to get for our listeners the phone number of FairTest if people want to get your report on kids called Testing Our Children, a report card on state assessment systems.
Yes, our phone number in Cambridge, Massachusetts is 617-864-4810. We also have a website, http://www.fairtest.org. Every single state report is, if it's not posted today, it will be by tomorrow. So you can go look for one state. I mean, this is a pretty long document, so I doubt you'd want to download them all, but you can order the report from us in Cambridge, or the executive summary, which gives us sort of the national summary picture of what's going on across the country with testing.
So the website is www.fairtest.org. That's
yes.
fairtest.org. And the phone number 617-864-4810. I just want to also let our listeners know that Republicans in Congress are saying that they will not support President Clinton's efforts to develop voluntary tests for fourth graders in reading and eighth graders in math. Republicans are saying that they will try to scuttle the plan, that the federal tests are a waste of taxpayers' money, says William Goodling of Pennsylvania. I'm looking at a piece in the Christian Science Monitor today on the brouhaha on national school testing. I want to thank you both very much for joining us, Moni Neal of FairTest and Susan Harmon, a special ed teacher in Contra Costa County, California. Thanks for being with us. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue on the issue of young people. Yes, tens of millions of children will return to school this week, but some won't be going to regular schools. They'll be heading to juvenile detention centers, which have undergone significant growth in recent years. A short while ago, I was able to talk with Bill Ayers, a teacher, a parent, and an activist in Chicago, Illinois. He's just written a new book called A Kind and Just Parent, The Children of Juvenile Court, which is published by Beacon Press. He was also, along with his wife, Bernadine Dorn, a member of the Weather Underground, a clandestine armed group of the early 1970s. Since then, he's taught high school and juvenile offenders in Chicago's largest youth detention center. I asked him about his reaction to the recent attempts in Congress to punish so-called super predators, or young violent offenders, with jail terms in adult prisons. In fact, it seems that this get-tough-on-crime trend, favored by so many politicians, is only just beginning.
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, the book is a response to that. It's my attempt to go into the juvenile court, into the juvenile jail, and to see how the kids themselves make sense of their predicament. I mean, I started off knowing that a lot of the ways we talked about these kids couldn't possibly be the way they thought about themselves. And so I went into the juvenile detention center and spent a couple years, but I document one complete year in the life of a classroom in the juvenile detention center in Chicago. And what I was really seeking was the kids' voices, with the kind of assumption that you can't really tell the story, you can't really understand the policy, you can't understand history if the voices of people themselves aren't there. And so this was my attempt to add the voices of the kids. So here we have a group of kids who are referred to routinely as super predators and pre-social beings and all these kind of intense language, this kind of agitated language. And what I was interested in is, how do the kids call themselves? What do they think of themselves? And that's really what I set out to capture.
Your book is really a series of stories about different young people, Alex and Ito and Jesus and Andrew. Tell us a few of these stories.
Well, I mean, I've become very close with a kid named Alex who tells a story, and Jeff, the book starts off with a kid named Jeff, and Jeff's and Alex's stories are quite parallel. In fact, lots of the kids followed a script somewhat like this. And the stories almost, I mean, they parallel in a haunting way Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist. Alex was a kid who was abused badly. He was an immigrant kid. He was abused as a kid and abandoned as a kid, and found himself at the age of 12 on the street, homeless, involved with alcohol and drugs, part of a screwball little street outfit that got money through muggings and petty street crime. And one day, at the age of 14, he began to get bigger and tougher, and he was employed by some older guys to do some heavier jobs. And one day, he found himself under a stairway. Somebody else had mapped out the plan, gotten the gun for him, handed him the gun. It was going to be easy money. He was going to knock over a guy who was bringing in a payroll. and he was going to use the gun to scare the guy. So the adult had provided the plan and the gun, and the kid was carrying out the action. Well, the guy who had the money resisted, and Alex shot him and was arrested and tried as an adult for murder one. So that's a standard story in some ways of some of the toughest kids I met, that they were, in a way, one day they were victims, the next day they were victimizers. Alex was really fortunate in that he found a way out of a lifetime in prison, and it really was based on finding a teacher who really believed in him. And that's, I think, a really compelling story kind of at the heart of this book. And Alex has worked his way out of prison and now is runs a successful business as a personal trainer.
How did he work his way out of prison?
Well, it was a combination, like most of our lives, it was a combination of chance and choices that he made. The choices were things like deciding that he was going to get away from a life of crime, and as he often says, inside the joint as well as outside, there's always criminal opportunities, there's always possibilities. But he decided, once he got himself clear of drugs and alcohol, that he was not going to be involved in crime. Then he began to set goals for himself. He was going to lift weights and make himself stronger, a kind of a standard 16-year-old boy goal. He was going to make himself have a big buff body, and then he decided that he was going to get a GED and get some degrees inside prison. He was going to get some of the professional degrees that they give, horticulture and so on. So he decided he was going to make something of himself, largely based on a teacher who kept saying to him, a teacher named Frank Tobin, who was an ex-priest, who kept saying to Alex, "You've committed a terrible act, but that doesn't make you a terrible person. And you should never allow society to define you by the worst thing you've ever done." And that was kind of something that rang in Alex's head. Don't let society define you by the worst thing you've ever done. And he began to think, well, what could I do? And he set goals for himself. So that was the choice part, making some good decisions, guided to make some good decisions. Then the chance part came when Illinois decided to move from a indeterminate to a determinate sentencing structure. And people who were in on indeterminate sentences were given out dates. So Alex got an early out date based on good time. And that's the way that he got himself out. And as I say, now he runs a personal training business in Chicago. He has a lot of clients who are, you know, wealthy, and he's doing quite well for himself. Not free of the scars of that childhood experience, but certainly a productive recover, you know, a person who recovered and now is a productive member of society.
Bill Ayers is a teacher and author of A Kind and Just Parent, The Children of Juvenile Court, which is published by Beacon Press. We're going to come back with him in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Bill Ayers, a teacher and author of A Kind and Just Parent, The Children of Juvenile Court.
What's happened with Jeff, a young man who also killed someone, 2 weeks after his 14th birthday?
Yeah, Jeff is a different story, and the book begins and ends with Jeff. It begins with Jeff's sentencing. Jeff was a kid I knew for about a year. I tutored him. And one of the things I learned, Amy, while I was in the juvenile detention center, I taught myself to not ask kids what they were in for, so I often didn't know. And the reason that's hard to do is because there's, a natural human instinct to say, what did you do? But it's this kind of unfair question because these kids are vulnerable, they're needy, they're frightened to death, and it's just one of these kind of setups. If an outsider, a grown-up, a professional, an older person, a white person, is saying to this kid, Jeff, what did you do? So I didn't know what Jeff had done. He was a little shy, goofy, screwball kind of adolescent kid. But it turned out that he also was a kid who was on his own on the streets, was swept up by one of the big, powerful street gangs in Chicago. And he did low-level kind of dealing for them until one day, 2 weeks after his 14th birthday, the gang boss came along and said, look, there's a guy encroaching on our territory. You come with me. I want you to take care of him. The gang boss handed him a gun. Jeff walked up to the other kid and shot him 8 times. One of the things that was disturbing about going to his sentencing hearing was how much that was the story was one in which Jeff, again, was a victim, but also a victimizer, and the kid he killed had been a victimizer and was now a victim. But in the way the law works and in the way we like to kind of see things as yes or no, black or white, Jeff was portrayed as a super predator, and the kid that he killed was portrayed as a pure victim. So it was kind of heartbreaking to watch Jeff get 47 years in prison. It was devastating for his family and really heartbreaking for me. At the end of the book, I published the most recent letters I had gotten from Jeff, and Jeff is doing hard time, and he's hoping to make something of his life also. He's now 16. But the chances are very thin for Jeff. I mean, we don't provide opportunities for recovery. You had mentioned the McCollum bill in the Senate, and that's one of the things that troubles me the most, is this idea that getting tougher and tougher and tougher will somehow provide the answer for this, for juvenile crime, rather than really examine either the underlying problems that cause it or providing some opportunity for kids to return, some opportunity for recovery.
Bill Ayers is our guest. He's a teacher, and he's written a book about his experiences called A Kind and Just Parent, The Children of Juvenile Court, and he works in Chicago. We deal a lot with the prison industrial complex on Democracy Now, and I thought you had an interesting line when you said, I was beginning to see a straight line between failing schools and burgeoning youth jails. That's really a critical point.
I think it is, and I think that one of the things that I discovered as I was working on this book, I am a teacher, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not really involved in criminal justice except as a citizen, but when I discovered that truancy was the clearest indicator of entanglement in the justice system, then I saw that my work for 10 years in the Chicago Public Schools, for example, to restructure and reform the big failing high schools in Chicago, is directly linked to what's happening. And now, I don't know if it's made the national news, but if you look in Chicago now, the superintendent has decreed that any kid charged with certain offenses, whether they're on school grounds or not, whether they're convicted or not, is going to be expelled from school. So what he's done is created an even further kind of escalation of this idea that you don't have a right to an education, you don't have a right to a health care system or mental health facilities or after-school facilities. The only entitlement left is the juvenile justice system for a lot of kids. And that is really a damning statement about our society, a really condemnatory statement that the only place you can go is juvenile justice and still be accepted. School, they'll push you out. The libraries, they'll push you out. The only place left really is justice, and that's really a shame.
What about the difference between boys and girls? I mean, I do know that the proportionately largest rate of growth in the prisons is of African-American women. But in terms of the young people that you dealt with, you profile all boys.
Well, you know, I found myself in a classroom that was a boys' classroom, and so that's where I spoke from, and even I do have a chapter called Girl Talk, and even that starts in the boys' classroom and their view of girls. One of the really horrendous aspects of the Cook County Detention Center is that all the kind of adolescent confusion and feelings and desires and so on about boys and girls are escalated and kind of animated by the fact that on a given day, there are 890 boys and about 50 girls under one roof. Now, that means that all the kind of caricatures and all the kind of gross stereotypes about boy-girl relationships get wildly escalated. in any case, I spent time with the boys and knew some of the girls, but knew them peripherally. In juvenile crime, girls are, the rate of growth of crime for girls is also hugely escalating and bigger than the rate of charged crimes for boys. But we shouldn't be fooled by that, because it's in some ways it's still tiny numbers, it's small numbers, but the rate of growth is increasing. But it is still true that most crime, most charged crime is juvenile crime is boys. Girls still work their way into juvenile justice around status offenses. And another astonishing thing that I discovered, although not astonishing, I guess, when you reflect on it, is that a lot of the girls who are charged with crimes are charged with crimes committed with adult men. So if you have a 16-year-old girl and her 19-year-old boyfriend go and rob a store, there's actually a prima facie case of statutory rape, but statutory rape isn't prosecuted any longer because it's not, I don't know, it's not a modern, there's no modern kind of acceptance of that as a crime. But if you look at it, you've got adult men manipulating juvenile women, and the girls get charged with these heavy felonies.
Again, Bill Ayers is our guest. His book, A Kind and Just Parent, it's published by Beacon. Before we go, I wanted to ask you about your own life experiences. You're well known in the 1960s for your work and activism, and your wife, Bernadine Dorn, was one of the Weather Underground. In fact, we were just talking before, and you said she was on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. Mm-hmm. How has that affected your life choices, and how do you connect your work in the 60s, yours and your wife's work, yours and Bernadine's work, to what you're doing today?
Well, you know, it's funny, when you live a life, there's a seamlessness to it, and I know that there's a kind of inevitable fascination with the years when we were underground. We were underground for 10 years, and the Weather Underground certainly took an extreme kind of gaudy step in opposition to the war, and we will kind of forever be known by that and for that. And I feel no... I feel no regrets about having taken that step. I think that we, while we didn't do everything right, that we were on the right side and that we were doing something that was important.
When did you become part of the Weather Underground?
We all went underground in 1970, and Bernadine and I surfaced in 1981, and by then we had two children. So we were underground for about 11 years, but you know, when I think of my life, you know, over 52 years, and I think I've raised kids for 20 years, being underground for 11 years, while it's significant, it's not all there is. There are many other aspects. But do I see a connection? Yes, I see a connection in this sense. From the time that I was conscious of being a social and a political person, which was in my late teens and early 20s, and feel very fortunate to have come of age during the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement and the great kind of political crisis that created, in the great moral space that opened up, I've seen my work as connected to the notion of participatory democracy, the notion of extending the participation of people in the decisions that affect their lives, the notion that the people who are most oppressed have solutions for the problems that we face collectively. And so I see my work in juvenile detention, I see my work in the Chicago schools as directly linked to peace and justice work, which is how I think I want to live.
And that was Bill Ayers. He's a teacher in Chicago and author of the book, A Kind and Just Parent, The Children of Juvenile Court, which is published by Beacon Press. And today we go out with some information on the Abner Louima case, the case of police torture in New York. The Haitian immigrant at the heart of the 70th Precinct police torture case was struggling to recover enough for a possible reunion with his six-year-old daughter today. Abner Louima suffered internal injuries stemming from his arrest on August 9th by police officers who broke up a fight outside a Brooklyn nightclub. They arrested Louima for disorderly conduct, although it's not clear that he was involved with the fight. According to prosecutors, the officers beat Louima and sodomized him inside a bathroom at the 70th Precinct Station House in Brooklyn, New York. Speaking yesterday in her native Creole, 6-year-old Avnia Samantha Luima said through a translator at a Brooklyn news conference that she loves and misses her father. The girl arrived in the city from Haiti last week, but Avner Luima has been too ill to see her. It's hoped that there will be a reunion today. Luima is listed in stable condition after being moved out of intensive care. Luima suffered a ruptured bladder and colon in the attack when a stick, perhaps a plunger handle, was shoved into his rectum by police. It then was pushed into his mouth, breaking several of his teeth. Authorities have said the attack was racially motivated. Luima said the officers used racial epithets as they beat him. 4 officers have been charged in the attack. Luima has filed a $55 million lawsuit against the city, although his attorneys say they'll amend that to seek $465 million. Last week, thousands of protesters shut down the Brooklyn Bridge to show support for Luima and demand an end to police brutality. And today we thought we would bring you the premiere of a song about his case. It's called The Ballad of Avner Luima by Stephen Smith, sung with Patti Smith and Oliver Ray.
Early one morning when the sun was down, Flatbush, part of New York town.
Oh, hello.
All one body gotta heal and grow. Abner Luima, his name, this is how he came to fame.
Hey, my back door.
When a club closed for the night, people broke into
back door.
Ooh, all one body got a healing crow. Justin Volpe, policeman, brought to the ground by an unknown man.
Hey-ho, keep my
cool. Volpe grabbed Luima, why, said he was just standing by.
Hey-ho, keep my cool.
All one body got a healing crow. Beat him in the car to the 7-0. Put him in a cell for an hour or so.
Ain't no fool. No,
drag him from his holding cell. Who to one no tongue can tell.
Hey, ho, ain't my fault.
All one body got a healing blow. Cause this crime, some said Giuliani time.
Hold up my back door.
Blame hate on mayor, blame police. All of us must hold this peace.
My back door.
Some old one body got a healing grow. For a while, 4 policemen bound for trial.
Hey, oh, be no foe.
And near 10,000 marched today. Some set to fight and some to pray.
Hey, oh,
all one body gotta heal and grow. My ma hear what she said. All one people on a judgment day.
Oh, I know.
Well, all one body got a healing
hope. Oh, I know.
Oh, ain't no fool. All one body got a healing
hope.
The Ballad of Avner Luima by Stephen Smith, sung with Patti Smith, the legendary rocker and Oliver Ray. And this was the premiere of that piece. Next Friday, the Congressional Black Caucus will be holding hearings on police brutality, and there will be a national rally against police brutality in Washington held by the Center for Constitutional Rights. The number there, 1-800-764-0235. That's 1-800-764-0235. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Thanks to Delphine Blue for the music and Spider Blue at the Uplink. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!